Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Wednesday, December 17th. I'm Olivia Rose. Petersburg's power went out around 7:30 last night for almost 2 hours after a tree 5 miles south of town fell into a major power line. Borough crew cut the tree out of the line and power was restored for all of Petersburg around 9:20. The crew had been working all that afternoon, addressing snowy trees and poles leaning in different parts of town, including the problem tree at 5 Mile before the outage occurred. They realized fixing that issue at 5 Mile would require both of the town's power feeds to be taken offline and moved over to diesel power in the meantime. But the diesel generators south of town at Scow Bay wasn't coming online like it should have, which meant there wouldn't be enough power to support the town. The problem tree at 5 Mile shed snow and let off the line, and so utility director Carl Hagerman decided the situation could wait until daylight returned, when it would be safer for the crew and customers. But Hagerman says that didn't go according to plan.
The crew was in the process of standing down, and about 30, 40 minutes later, the problem tree decided it was meant to be down. So it came back into the line, caused the fault, and that's when we had the outage. So because the crew was basically still available, we were able to respond very quickly to the situation.
Hagerman says it was unfortunate, but no one was hurt and the power was restored fairly quick in the community. He says an engineer is coming to Petersburg today to help sort out the issue with the Scow Bay generator, which had tested normally yesterday morning. He says it's important for all of the town's diesel fleet to be available, especially with the colder forecast coming and power use climbing. Local showings for a documentary about Petersburg doubled as a fundraising opportunity for the community's struggling nonprofit movie theater. As KFSK's Taylor Heckert reports, more than $8,000 was raised in 2 days earlier this month.
When New Jersey-based director Brian Bill was working on the documentary Tide and Table, he knew he wanted the first showing of the film to be in Petersburg. The film features the food and community of Petersburg, and Bill wanted the community's approval before showing Tide and Table to a broader audience. The production reached out to Petersburg's only movie theater, the Northern Nights Theater. After connecting with theater manager Cindy Fry, Bill decided that the premiere of the film would double as a fundraiser for the space.
And when Cindy talked about how the theater is just in need of just constant repair, that's when we decided, like, let's treat this as a fundraiser.
The Northern Nights Theater is a nonprofit that partners with the local school district and employs high school students. It's been struggling to stay open and pay its bills as operating costs have continued to rise. In an interview with KFSK, Fry said that money has been incredibly tight.
So we've just been literally treading water all year, trying to make sure that we can keep the theater in operation for our community.
Bill's production company, Two Doors Down Productions, donated $3,000 to the theater. They made tickets to the three showings of Tide and Table free. In return, they asked attendees to donate whatever they saw fit. The community donated over $5,000 during the film's three showings, raising a total of $8,000 for the theater. Fry says the fundraising has been amazing. She says this money will ensure that the theater can keep operating.
It's hard to express how much gratitude we have for this donation and this event that was really unexpected.
This money comes at a normally costly time of year for the theater. Big bills like insurance are due in the fall, and this fundraiser puts the theater at a starkly different spot than it was this time last year.
Last year at this time, we identified that, man, we are just really, we don't know if we're going to make it. So I just asked what our account balance was right now. And I just heard from our account, it's about $1,500 before these donations that are in our account.
This donation is over five times the amount of money the theater had in savings. Fry says she hopes to be able to put some aside for a necessary replacement to the seats in the auditorium. Those upgrades would impact more than just the movie theater. The space is housed in the middle school and is also an important space for theater, dance, and musical performances. Bill, the director, says that's why the fundraising was so important.
It's a vital part of the community, the way it's used for not just showing of films, but also for the arts and for education.
That $8,000 figure isn't even the final dollar amount. The proceeds from merchandise sold at the showings are still being counted. Bill says he has no plans to make any revenue from this film. Instead, future screenings will be fundraisers for the theater as well.
I feel the best way to do this, because I'm based in New Jersey, is probably do it like a GoFundMe page. So this way they can get the funds directly after each showing, and then we can also promote it like on our channels as well.
In the meantime, that $8,000 will be able to ease some of the stress on the community's theater. In Petersburg, I'm Taylor Heckert.
Alaska's sea otter population has grown since being reintroduced to the region in the 1960s. The species preys on clams and crabs, which are profitable fisheries throughout the state. But Alaska native fashion artist Christy Ruby wants to keep the species' population under control by eventually building Southeast's only large-scale tannery for harvested sea otters. KRBD's Hunter Morrison dropped by Ruby's studio in Ketchikan to find out how a recently awarded Rasmussen Foundation grant could help her achieve this goal.
And Christy, your first question to me when we met was something sort of along the lines, if you could kind of fill me in here.
Yeah. What if we had an all expenses paid of seal and sea otter tannery that would provide low cost, high quality fur hides to all of our Alaska Native artists? But it's actually a full circle when you think about it. How about the seafood industry, Native organizations and environmental protectors and all the boaters in the ocean? Working together on a phone app created just to locate the whereabouts of the sea otters. You can enter that in and lock it in, and then the sea otter hunters will know where to go. And it also helped the environmental protection agencies on where the otters are at.
And you also, you didn't really end there. You sort of went on to talk about, paying visitors to Ketchikan every summer.
Yes, and this concept idea I have of this dream tree, which we'll get into later, is about what if we could have thousands of paying visitors every summer at this tannery I'd like to build, and they would take a tour of our powerful Native history, sewing skills, and learn and purchase fur handicrafts.
And you sort of showed me the piece of paper there with a lot of handwritten words that are shaped into sort of large tree, a large tree with branches titled the Dream Tree. And you said something to the effect of, this is the solution that will remedy everyone's angry issues and with those cute little sea otters. Is that right?
Yeah, everybody has their thorns on their sides. And I'm pretty sure the seafood industry just loves those little cute otters eating, gobbling up all their food and profits. So this tannery concept, along with a tour and a sewing center, would provide a full circle of to the economy, bringing tourists, visitors, repurposed hides, seal hides and sea otter hides at low cost. It's just amazing, this tree that I built that can do a full circle of environmental, and it's just waiting in the wind.
This is, I want to kind of go back to this sort of the larger stepping stone for this dream tree. This grant is that larger stepping stone. And in your grant proposal, you sort of mentioned building a small scale personal tannery, which is a sort of step backwards after working on sort of large scale commercial tanning equipment.
Yeah, that's the problem is when you do professional seal shaving on a large device, it's really hard to go back to small. The proposal that I offered the Rasmussen was part of the grant's policy was to train people afterwards with tanning seal and show them the tricks, and maybe they can purchase some equipment also that can allow them to tan their seal, because there's a huge shortage in Alaska for fresh and properly tanned seal skins.
One of your goals is to, and kind of is supplemented with this this grant, is to perfect the tanning process and then teach via videos about your processes. You'll also, I believe, is host start Zoom meetings twice a month. Anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, actually, you just don't want to waste what you know. And if I can just share what I know with one person and alleviate that 6 months worth of frustration of them trying to figure it out, that's what I'm going to do. Because we all need to share. And it's, we're only cutting ourselves off from the whole world if we don't share. And I think the more we share our secrets and our skills, and everybody will prosper and will save the actual skin traditions that our elders are wishing we would have.
And one thing that you mentioned is a constant complaint that you hear after you introduce yourself and your profession. Would you like to?
I try not to say I'm a hunter, but I, you know, dabble in seal fashions and sea otter fashions. And the first comment I get is, why aren't you harvesting more sea otters? Well, the reason is because Alaska Natives can harvest sea otters, but they have nowhere to tan them. We have two tanneries left in Alaska, or actually one in Alaska and one in Idaho. So that's probably why we're not hunting as many otters, because we just don't have any good quality tanneries to send them to. So why bother?
Right.
After the tannery in New Jersey, which was the last garment tanner in the U.S., shut down, it's really hard to lower your standards. And your customers, my customers, demand good quality. They're not going to wear a stinky fur. But it is a stepping stone to the bigger dream tree, which we will talk about later.
That was KRBD's Hunter Morrison speaking with Ketchikan fashion artist and Rasmussen Grant winner Christy Ruby about her vision to build a large-scale tannery for harvested sea otters. You can hear the full version of this interview with Ruby at krbd.org. The Arctic continues to warm faster than other parts of the world and is experiencing record high temperatures and record low levels of sea ice. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which released its annual report card for the region yesterday. As the Alaska Desk's Alona Naden reports, those findings directly affect Alaska communities.
The Arctic report card has been documenting changes in snow and sea ice cover, as well as air and ocean temperatures in the northern part of the globe for the past 20 years. It has shown that in that time, the Arctic's annual temperature has increased at more than double the global rate of temperature changes. Hannah Marie Ladd is the director of Indigenous Sentinels Network, a tribally owned program that helps Alaska Native communities monitor their environment. She's also a lead author of this year's Arctic Report card for the chapter about community-led observations on St. Paul Island in the Bering Sea.
These changes cascade directly into people's lives, affecting fisheries, coastal safety, and subsistence harvests. We are no longer just documenting warming. We are witnessing an entire marine ecosystem, which is tied to our economies and culture, transform within a single generation.
Ladd was one of roughly half a dozen speakers from various research agencies who detailed this year's report at a press conference. The report is the work of more than 100 authors from 13 countries. One big takeaway is that the Arctic region experienced some of the highest temperatures since the turn of the century. Matthew Druckenmiller is a senior scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado and lead editor of this year's report.
October 2024 through September 2025, the Arctic experienced the highest temperatures on record since at least 1900. This included the warmest autumn, the second warmest winter, in the third warmest summer ever observed.
The rapid warming of the Arctic is amplified by the loss of reflective sea ice and snow. The report showed that last March, Arctic winter sea ice reached its lowest annual maximum extent in nearly 50 years of satellite records. Druckenmiller says that the oldest, thickest ice has also declined by over 95% since the 80s.
This thinner ice is then much more mobile with wind and current, and much less resilient against warming waters. This means much more unpredictable ice conditions for those both living and working in the Arctic.
The Arctic is changing on land too. The report highlights an emerging phenomenon called rusting rivers. That's when permafrost thaw causes groundwater to seep deeper and interact with mineral deposits, which likely turns some streams and rivers to a rusty orange color. Abigail Pruitt is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Davis, who studies rusting rivers. She says that in Alaska, over 200 streams turned orange in recent years, and that affected aquatic biodiversity and water quality.
Within Kobuk Valley National Park, we observed the complete loss of juvenile Dolly Varden and Slimy Sculpin in a tributary to the Akilik River when it turned orange. Beyond the effects on fish, resting rivers may impact drinking water supplies to rural communities as well.
The report highlights how indigenous communities have been observing the changes in the environment and wildlife and collaborating with scientists to better understand those changes. Ladd with the Indigenous Sentinels Network describes one example of such work. She says that St. Paul residents collect samples of harvested traditional foods, like seabirds, marine mammals, and halibut. Those samples are tested in a tribally owned lab and, with the help from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, analyzed for contaminants like mercury. She says it is a model for resilience, data sovereignty, and collaborative research.
Indigenous leadership, local workforce development, and community-driven observing are not optional. They are essential to understanding the Arctic that we have today and preparing for the Arctic we are moving into.
In response to a question about how federal cuts to climate science might affect the future of the Arctic report card, NOAA officials said that they will continue their efforts to observe the change in environment. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naiden.
For KFSK, I'm Olivia Rose.